Originally, the cherry trees were planted so that the beautiful blossoms would console the souls of fallen soldiers. As the wheel of militarization accelerated, this metaphor was extended so that falling cherry petals represented soldiers who sacrificed their lives, and blooming cherry blossoms at the Yasukuni Shrine became the metamorphosed souls. Not only was their apotheosis guaranteed, but they would be honored by the visits to the shrine by the emperor on special occasions.
Cherry blossoms are just one of the symbols of Japan that the government of Japan reinterpreted when it wanted the country to go to war. How effective was that effort? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Why did almost 1,000 highly educated student soldiers volunteer to serve in kamikaze operations when it was clear that Japan was losing the war? How convinced was the Japanese civilian population that the war was necessary? And how were the national symbols reclaimed and redirected after the war? Our guest is Emiko Anuki Tierney, Vilas Professor of Anthropology at the UW-Madison and author of various books, including Kamikaze Diaries and Kamikaze Cherry Blossoms and Nationalisms, both published by the University of Chicago Press.
And welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you. I'm honored.
I have to say, the title of one of your books, Kamikaze Cherry Blossoms and Nationalisms, it seems such a strange juxtaposition to take something as beautiful and delicate as a cherry blossom and then link it together with the kamikaze war violence. Can you tell us about the sort of the genesis of this book, you know, what brought you to this study and how cherry blossoms became a symbol of war?
Well, actually, I had no idea that cherry blossoms were used by the military government at all. When I wanted to do group rituals, and so I started to visit cherry blossom viewings in the spring. And then somebody pointed out that that was used by the military. And then suddenly my whole focus changed. And so what I wanted to know were two things. One is that how, when the symbol has many, many meanings, how do people really understand that they are reading the same meaning? And I think these 1,000 student soldiers who read thousands of books in their original Latin, Greek, and German, French, and English did not realize when they saw a beautiful pink petal, a cherry petal on the side of the plane, and then many of the corps were named after various names for cherry blossoms. And why did they not articulate that link in their mind became an intriguing point about how we communicate through symbols. But the kamikaze is one of the most misunderstood phenomena, just because there were two so-called kamikaze, and we call it special attack forces, Tokotan. One was Pearl Harbor, and at that time there was a way to return, so it was not one-way mission. But then at the end of the war, the Onishi Takejiro came up with this one-way mission, and there was no way that pilots once on board, which were forced, would return. But that whole operation was not volunteered soldiers. The Tojo government shortened the university twice, and so they, unless you're in science or education, you are forced to be drafted. And then at one point, they are summoned to a great hall and were asked, those who want to volunteer, step forward, or those who do not want to volunteer, remain. And by that time, they went through enormously rigorous tortures, actually, on the base. And so there was no way that they can say, well, I'm going to save my life, you guys go. And so that really was never a volunteer. And it comes very clearly in the diaries, which was my second book, Kamikaze Diaries, that they really were agonizing over why do they have to die at such an early age. And none of them really endorse emperor system or the militarization of Japan. And some of them were very sympathetic towards civilian casualties as they invaded Shanghai or the North China and all that.
One of them refers to the difficulty of, but the inevitability of attacking enemies that I do not hate.
That's right. And that's exactly what they said about they did not hate. This is Sasaki Hachiro is quoting a very well-known poet who is revered even today. And there are many societies dedicated to this. And he refers to Goethe's Faust before the gate. And then he quotes from poets and said that, I don't know if I'm supposed to win this war, but I will fight as much as I can, leaving my fate in your hands. And this is about deity. I pray that we will see the day as soon as possible when we welcome a world in which we do not have to kill enemies whom we cannot hate. For this end, I would not mind my body being ripped innumerable times.
And you're right that that gives a depth to the kamikaze thinking that is not part of the stereotype. The stereotype is of sort of single-minded, a mission without even questioning it. Why do you think the stereotype is there? You said this is one of the most misunderstood of phenomena. Why is it that we have a stereotype that the kamikaze pilots welcomed death, didn't question it, you know, were not sort of filled with complex, agonizing thoughts?
Well, there are two reasons. One is this, the end of the war was the last hurrah for the Japanese officials. They knew that they would never come back, and they forced this operation. But it was at the end of the war, so even the Japanese government did not have accurate statistics. So we don't even know exactly how many died. And then that's the same thing on American side. But I think Americans, not just Americans, but then inscrutable Orientals is a very much of a stereotype. And I think in part that was reinforced by the Japanese propaganda, or even Nitobe Inazo, who is a enormously cosmopolitan intellectual who served at the League of Nations with Madame Curie, Bergson, and Einstein and all this. But then he wrote in English first a book about the warrior's way. And then the first page of that book said that cherry blossoms and the warrior's way are indigenous to Japan. And this Japanese soul is supposed to be able to face death without hesitation. And therefore, the stereotype is to a certain degree linked to this Japanese notion that we alone can die without hesitation.
There must have been a little bit of a shift, or maybe a very big shift, as the war progressed, even for kamikazes, from, and you make the distinction in one of your books, between the German attitude, which was that you were supposed to go out and kill for your country, and the Japanese attitude was that you're supposed to go out and die for your country.
That's right. That's right. It's a very, I still don't understand how this, your own death was foregrounded before killing the enemies. Which
it's kind of a negative attitude, isn't it?
And the Nazis, Hitler, you know, said kill the enemies, but that wasn't the case.
On a practical level, did the kamikaze efforts, did it really make sense to lose lives in that way? Even if you go back to Pearl Harbor, you know, just looking at it from a strategic, practical point of view, what was behind the thought of sending people into these really suicide missions?
You know, that is something I will never forgive my government, but I don't think they're really in the mentality that they have to defend their country. They did not really think of exterminating, actually, the intellectual leaders after the war. All of these students would have been rebuilding Japan, and but then somehow these really crazy officials at the top, it really did not enter in their mind.
So it was almost a kind of national suicide in a way, because they lose this entire generation of creative thinkers and leaders.
That's right. And then they try to persuade the people that we should fight against Americans until the last Japanese remains. And so that was the kind of a mentality that is so ridiculous in hindsight, but that's how they did. But I don't think people believed it.
No. Why were, just again from a practical standpoint, why were the latter-day kamikaze missions suicide missions? Because there wasn't enough gas to get the plane back to Japan?
That's right. They, in the first place, I think the bomb was at the cockpit, and it's very heavy. You can't turn around. And then there was no gas to return. And then on the base that you're told to go on the mission, and then sometimes they can't find the aircraft carrier and return.
The target.
And there was one KO student who returned 9 times, and he was shot to death. And if you refuse to go on this mission, or if you keep returning, then they will send them to the southern front, where their death would be guaranteed anyway.
And whose idea was it to put cherry blossoms on, as a design on the planes? Like, how did that come about? That it seems, again, such a mismatch, such an incongruous thing to take a plane that is going to be destructive of life and to put a cherry blossom on it.
Well, I think the cherry blossoms always symbolize, you know, opposing meanings, life as well as death, and then warriors as well as geisha. But cherry blossom always had this kind of ephemeral aesthetic of beautiful life. And so the government used this by saying that thou shalt die like beautiful cherry petals after a short life. And so cherry blossom became the metaphor for life that was short, but then cut short and fall to the ground. And so they systematically used cherry blossoms from the very end of the 19th century. And then the Navy first and the Army incorporated cherry blossoms in their insignia. And the Yasukuni Shrine published a book on which there are 10 pink cherry petals falling, and that is symbolizing those soldiers who sacrificed their lives for the emperor. But I think that's the trick about symbols, very rich symbols, which have so many meanings. The roses are the same way, that beautiful but has thorns.
As in the War of the Roses.
That's right. And then even Aztecs, the wars are all symbolized by flowers.
Well, and it is interesting, too, that in places you've picked out photographs that show during World War II, other situations in which flowers were used to such effect. You have, we've all seen probably pictures of Hitler receiving flowers, bouquets from little girls during these big public events, for example. And so it was a... not just the Japanese, but they used them perhaps to greatest effect.
That's right. The roses were used as a symbol of love between individuals. But then that was picked up very much by the Socialist International. And so even today, if you look at the logos of socialist parties all over the world, most of them had red roses, and some of them on them with a clenched fist. And at the end of the beginning of the 20th century, a Russian prisoner, Jewish, broke out of a sauerkraut barrel from Siberia, and then went through China, Japan, San Francisco, and landed in New York, and gave a tremendous oratory, and thousands of workers got together, and that's when the goddess of spring is giving the roses from the top, and the workers receiving it. And then the bread and roses, that song and phrase came out of. And so roses, too, have very interesting and opposing meanings.
And the soldiers that took part in the kamikaze missions with the cherry petals on the plane, do you know from reading the different diaries and things that they were aware of the symbolism and how it was being used? I mean, did they sort of, as you were reading what they wrote, do they refer to the cherry blossoms or feeling like their lives are like that? Or did the propaganda work?
It's a very difficult question, because some of them would talk, use those phrases that the government sent out, but not necessarily with a belief. And that's the tricky part about it. For example, Hayashi Ichizo, on one day, he would say, there must be some meaning to die for the emperor. Several days later, he would say, that is not exactly what I think. And that's why my publisher wanted hundreds of diaries. And I said, no, I want to rather choose diaries that have a very long period, and trying to see contradictions and agonies and all this. It's not like you decide to fight for the emperor and go all the way through. It's not that simple. And then, of course, they start thinking about their, especially the mothers, because most of them are young men. And so at that time, they are supposed to take care of the mothers when they grow up. And so they're all saying that we are dying before we can even take care of our mothers. And the mothers, some of them, really struggled to raise these brilliant sons. And one of them, for example, was so poor that he had to work at his brother's lab, who was a brilliant chemist, and ate these feed for the experimental
for the rats.
Animals. Yeah. And so that's how they struggled.
Well, so this becomes as it so often does, I suppose, in war, a conflict between devotion to family and devotion to country.
That's right. That's right. And I think the what is patriotism is a very, very complicated question, and there are many, many answers, I think. And one, Sasaki Ichiro and then Hayashi, in fact, literally said that I'm dying for Japan, but not this Japan. But new Japan that will rise out of the ashes of the destroyed Japan like a phoenix. And so they are trying to rationalize by saying, I'm dying not for this Japan, but then so that there will be new Japan after the destruction. So, and they are dying for that purpose.
So they were idealists.
Well, yes.
Forced idealism.
That's right. That's right. Forced, because it's very difficult. At first, I didn't realize that was really a rationalization. They're desperately trying to find the reason why they have to die.
Find some kind of positive core to this experience,
yes,
that they're about to undergo.
In the absence of this so-called patriotism to Japan or the emperor at that time.
We're going to look more at the link between kamikaze, cherry blossoms, and nationalisms when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Emiko Onuki Tierney, and we are talking about her book, Kamikaze, Cherry Blossoms, and Nationalisms. I have to say that one of the things in both your books, in that one and also in the Kamikaze Diaries, that will always stay in my mind would be the excerpts from the student soldiers, the ones who died. You found their diaries and translate a lot of their thinking, you know, prior to their fatal missions. And I think it just made them real in a way that I had never thought of them. I've never thought about the loss of so much intellect and so much depth in these young men. Can you say something about, like, a sample Kamikaze diary entry?
All right. The Hayashitadao, who was the student, very brilliant student at University of Imperial University of Kyoto, had a title of the diaries, Loneliness and Longing for Life, Waste of Thought Processes. In my case, there is a great deal of it. For example, in vain I ask, how long will I live? Now it is before the dawn. It is 3 o'clock at night, 3 a.m. I do not want to die. I will try to live a full life. I want to live. No, I don't want to die. I feel lonely. I don't know why I feel so lonely. Being isolated, feeling the poverty of the self. And then he composed a poem, exquisitely erotic, Her Smile for Me. The image of the maiden, how distant it is now. Dusk, that most beautiful moment, with no pattern appear and disappear. Millions of images, beloved people, how unbearable to die in the sky. Mm-hmm. And this fellow was especially tragic because he died a day after the Potsdam Declaration.
The day after the initiation of the
That's
peace.
Right.
Yeah, so it makes it even more tragic somehow.
That's right. So his brother edited his diaries, and the title of the book is The Light Burning in the Moon or something.
You also include a soldier's reflections the night before the fatal flight. Can you say something about that before we hear that read by Norman?
Yes, and to continue with this Hayashi, another poem is The End of Imperial Japan. Ruining, crumbling, decadence. Nothing will be left. The end of all this fall. Lonely and chilly wind will blow. There will be nothing left. All will crumble. Japan will meet its finale, that taboo catastrophe. In other words, all of these, I think most of the Japanese, especially these soldiers, knew in already 1941 that there was no chance for Japan to win. And so they knew that their missions had no practical purpose.
Were these diaries that they kept with them during combat, or were they all written before they left home? I know that for a lot of Americans, although history has proven that they didn't follow this rule very closely, for a lot of American military personnel, it was against the rules to keep a diary. The main reason being that, of course, if that diary were captured, it might be useful to the enemy. But things like this, I would think the Japanese government would not want getting out in any event.
Well, one thing is that I think the custom is now declining, but Japanese were very, very keen on keeping diaries. And that's why the medieval women's diaries became the world literature. And so they, for example, one soldier kept diary, I found from the sixth grade on. And so I have an enormous length of time during which they wrote diaries. Now, after they are drafted, of course, there was enormous censorship. And so what they did was they wrote diaries, and sometimes they said after the light was turned off, and then ask somebody who visited them at the base to smuggle it out, Or one trick was to use the oil paper underneath the bed of rice and then put the diaries. And at that time, of course, Japanese outside who are not soldiers were really starving to death. And so whenever the parents and others came, they would give their rice lunch and meals to them. And so the diaries would be hidden underneath.
Presumably some of the soldiers who were so torn about, you know, I don't want to die, but I have to die, and kind of the back and forth, when it got to be right before a mission was going to happen, they would have to, in effect, psych themselves up to get themselves in the kind of frame of mind that they could get in that plane. What sort of reflections happened as they were about to take flight?
By that time, I don't think they had an individual choice. In other words, first of all, they didn't have a choice but to volunteer, quote-unquote volunteer. And once they are there, how can you say, I'm going to chicken out? And so I really don't think they had any individual choice in the behavior other than to just to pretend to be the model soldier, so to speak.
You're talking about sort of the model soldier and the idealism and the reflections, one thing, but of course we know that another thing that soldiers and sailors and flyers do under stress before going out is to really cut loose, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is one account that you've provided. This comes from a diary, I think, of this occasion at a Navy airbase.
Yes, this is a fellow who found my publication and contacted me. And he said that he took care of these soldiers daily and wanted to talk to me. But then he was already in wheelchair because he was beaten so much on the base. And so he came where I was staying in a wheelchair and then gave this diary, the description of his observation of these young soldiers a day before their departure.
It was a young man named Kasuga?
Yes.
Who was drafted and assigned to look after the meals in the laundry room cleaning and other daily tasks for student soldiers at this airbase. And he describes the night before their final flights like this. At the hall where their farewell parties were held, the young student officers drank cold sake the night before their flight. Some gulped the sake in one swallow. Others kept gulping down a large amount. The whole place turned into mayhem. Some broke hanging light bulbs with their swords. Some lifted chairs to break the windows and tore white tablecloths. A mixture of military songs and curses filled the air. While some shouted in rage, others cried aloud. It was their last night of life. They thought of their parents, their faces and images, and lovers' faces and their smiles, a sad farewell to their fiancés. All went through their minds like a running horse lantern, although they were supposedly ready to sacrifice their precious youth the next morning for Imperial Japan and for the Emperor. They were torn beyond what words can express, some putting their heads on the table, some writing their wills, some folding their hands in meditation, some leaving the hall, and some dancing in frenzy while breaking flower vases. They all took off wearing the rising sun headband the next morning. But this scene of utter desperation has hardly been reported. I observed it with my own eyes as I took care of their daily life, which consisted of incredibly strenuous training, coupled with cruel and torturous corporal punishment as a daily routine.
So that's a very striking description, and I guess it's not one that we would find in actual diaries of the soldiers who died.
That's right.
Because they wouldn't have, at that point, made an entry.
Yes. I think these are very important because many of the last wills were published, but they were forced on the base. Someone said that write your wills so that we can put them up as a model soldier's wills. Well, how can you say something blasphemous?
Right. So. Now, you mentioned that for some of the soldiers it was very hard because they would have been expected to care for their mothers, in some case mothers that had sacrificed so much to get them through school. Mm-hmm. Do you have some examples from diary entries where they do refer to their mothers?
Yes, when I think how mommy, this is another University of Kyoto student who really returns to kind of a baby talk, childhood. And so rather than saying mother, he starts with mother, but then he, as he goes on, it becomes mommy, and it's very much of a childhood dialogue. But when I think how mommy struggled so hard to raise me, I find it so hard to leave you behind without ever having given you pleasure or peace of mind. I still want to be spoiled by you. There is nothing more that pleases me than your letters. I wish I could see you once more. I want to be held in your arms and sleep. I'm writing this letter when my final flight is the day after tomorrow.
Hmm. Was there a shift in thinking as Japan became more and more on the defensive? In other words, it's one thing to go out and attack an enemy that you don't hate. It's another to defend the homeland and your family from attack.
I think that's a very good rhetoric I think many governments use, homeland attack, in order to fan
sure,
the patriotism.
Sure, of course, yes.
Yes,
uh-huh.
And so the Japan did, you know, the Americans would come and land and rape the women and then kill, and so we have to fight for our homeland. And that, I think, all through the history, you can see that in the...
I mean, were they saying the same kind of thing, though, even before, Pearl Harbor? They were already, attacking in China and in Southeast Asia before America was even in the war. How did they motivate these young men to go out and risk their lives at that point, if it's not a defensive war at this point?
Yes, I think that was a totally different strategy. In a sense, it was an imperial expansion. And what they came up with is East Asia called prosperity. And so they try to tell the soldiers that the Japan is doing something good for these countries against the Western nations. Because at that time, Japan was the only country that was not colonized.
Right.
By the West. And so it was a good rhetoric to say that Japan will be the leader in protecting all these Asian countries against Western powers.
And now that I think of it, they did fabricate some kind of an anti-Japanese event in Manchuria to justify going in there.
Yes, I think there were lots of levels of the soldiers who went to Manchuria, North China, and all that, you do have various levels of reactions. And then soldiers are very different, too. Japan was the first to have the universal constrict. And so the sons from rural Japan, interestingly, Japan was supposed to be a rice-eating country. But many of the peasants never were able to eat rice because they were all taken as tax. And so when the modernization started, that the government said that to the women, if you come and work in a factory in the city, we will provide you with rice three times a day. And then some of the peasant soldiers ate rice for the first time on the base. And so those were different from others who were drafted. And so their attitude towards the colonized were very varied. Some of them are not as what you wished. But then this is the first time they were brainwashed to think that other agents were inferior.
Yes.
To the Japanese,
yes,
right?
Yes. We still can see some of that today.
Whereas the educated soldiers, they would write in a poem of farewell to a Chinese that he became a friend for, and one said that all the officers spend their lives with the prostitutions and mahjong. And very critical of the Japanese imperial invasions.
I have a sort of personal question for you. I noticed that the dedication of your book is to your grandmother, and you say, my grandmother who bore an incredible pain throughout her life, losing two sons to the war. Can you say something about the sort of personal connection you felt between the content of your book and then your own family history?
Well, I think my grandmother kind of represent the Japanese mothers, all of these mothers who really suffered by raising their sons, and then sons went to top universities, and they are to die. And at that time, I think the system was that grandmother was really very bright and enormously good looking, but the system did not allow her to work. And so the only way was that her sons to take care of her at her old age. And here they were drafted, and one died during the carpet bombing in Tokyo. And so I think she represents the sufferings of the woman at that time on two points. One is that the system forced them to depend upon their sons. And then they had no choice but to see their sons perish for no good reasons. And I think Hayashi's mother, in fact, say that in a poem. She was a devout Christian, so was her son. And the son said that when I read Bible, I feel next to you. And he wanted to join her, and he said that, Mother, do you think you can come to heaven where I would be and be reunited? And she wrote beautiful poems by saying that why do we have to lose our sons? And it is the period of Japanese history which forced this kind of sacrifice.
What was the role of women in this, national effort, we'll call it, of war? If the men did the fighting and the women stayed at home, what did the cherry blossom tell the women other than that it was glorious to sacrifice their children?
Well, the government had an enormous effort to tell women how it is honorable to gladly have their sons sacrificed. I mean, it's in their songs and school textbooks and stories, and they would say that it is the utmost virtue of the mothers to willingly sacrifice their sons. But I think they did that in Germany, too.
And in ancient Rome, Roman Empire, too.
That's right, yeah. That's right. And so they don't want the women to go against the militarization. So they have used enormous tactics. And then you couldn't really, at that time, go publicly resist the... By 1940s, whoever publicly opposed the government were jailed or tortured to death. So if the mother says, no, I don't want my son to go, then she is endangering the whole family, including herself as well as her son.
And what did Japan use as a – did Japan, as certainly the United States did, and I'm not sure about Germany to some extent, though, I'm sure that they used women in the labor force to replace the men who were not in the factories. Did that kind of thing happen in Japan, or was it just a matter of getting the labor elsewhere?
Yes, they did. Well, even high school students, men, boys and girls, were sent to factory to work. And then not every woman civilian, but there is a lot of forced women labor. And then also in that Clint Eastwood film, there is a scene of the women themselves telling other mothers how it is a virtue to sacrifice their sons. And so they utilize women a great deal.
There are some striking parallels between some of the things you're talking about and things today, suicide missions and other things, and things that we can learn from about nationalism and symbolism. We'll talk about that and more about the kamikaze when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Amiko Onuki-Tierney, and we're looking at the way the Japanese government in the 20th century, and especially leading up to World War II, used certain national symbols, foremost among them the cherry blossom, to get Japanese soldiers in particular to subscribe to the idea that it was a well-thought thing to die for the emperor. And this will expand, I think, pretty quickly into a discussion of how national symbols are used for these purposes in general. But I can't resist asking, in the meantime, about the famous cherry trees in Washington, D.C., which in 1909 were a gift from the Japanese. And then here we have World War II come along. The Japanese have attacked American facilities in Pearl Harbor. We're in a very brutal war, and we have blossoming in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, these cherry trees. What was the attitude toward the cherry trees in Washington, if we're talking about symbols?
Well, that's a very interesting phenomenon in two reasons. One is that whenever there is a war going on, that does not necessarily mean the people become antagonistic towards the enemies, personally speaking. And so very often, so the cherry blossoms, opposite meanings, one is to towards the militarization, and the other one is the symbol of love and personal relationships. But this is very interesting in a sense that Japan did not think of cherry blossoms as a national flower until Mrs. Taft was enchanted by cherry blossoms when she accompanied her husband. So the first lady was very enchanted. And then there is this Skidmore, who wanted to have the cherry trees brought to D.C. And so she persisted, and with the two women, the city of Tokyo sent many seedlings of cherry trees. The first was, it's a little controversial, but supposed to have had some worms. And so they were all burned.
Unfortunate symbolism there.
yes. And then they had another shipment. And so they planted. And now during the war, there was an incident of some trying to damage the trees, but they were not able to really identify why they did that. And that kept going. And now it's just enormously gorgeous. I was at the Library of Congress for 6 months, including cherry blossom time. And I joined Cherry Blossom Festival, and now it's an international scene. When you get there, you hear many, many languages because so many tourists also joined. So that's a very good way that how the better side of humanity gets expressed, even when something very ugly is going on.
Was the terminology changed at all? I mean, the names for these trees during the war, as this so often happens during the wartime?
Yes, I think they changed from the Japanese cherry trees to, I remember it was Oriental cherry trees or something, rather than accentuating that is from Japan.
Japan. Sort of like French fries becoming freedom fries. That kind of thing.
Yes.
Are there links that you see with the material that you've worked on in this particular period in Japanese history and today in terms of how symbols get used during war, how they become part of a kind of aesthetics that get used? Or do you see this as just sort of part of the past and not still spilling over into what's around us now?
Well, I think one of the very common phenomenon is to use some material object, especially something that is beautiful. Sensory perception is beautiful. And then transfer that to a concept, especially patriotism. So every patriotism is considered to be beautiful. And at that time, I think it's very, for example, with this Republican and Democratic conventions, and the patriotism is very much foregrounded. You are supposed to find a cause beyond yourself in patriotism. In other words, you want to do something for your country. So during the war, the Japanese soldiers, students, all of us knew that their fine patriotism could not be directed to Japan at that time. But I think there is always this, what is patriotism and how do you beautify patriotism? And the patriotism can be many shades and from whose perspective. So I think it's a very important subject matter, and think about various perspectives about patriotism.
You, I know we're going to be linking on our website some images that you have in a PowerPoint, because there's a lot of visuals that go along with the presentation of cherry blossoms in art and so on. Can you say something about some of the images that our listeners would be able to see from the website?
Yes, I think it starts with many woodblock prints. And as you know, the Van Vleck woodblock prints at the Chazen Museum is the best in the world in terms of one of the woodblock, Hiroshige. And then it starts with how the in ancient Japan, cherry blossom was supposed to be the spring counterpart of rice in the fall. If beautiful cherry blossoms, you can expect a good harvest of rice. So there's a scene of cherry blossoms with rice paddies. And then I have a series of medieval cherry blossom viewings. And then I have juxtaposing the cherry blossom standing for warriors, but at the same time, geisha. And one of the almost every master of woodblock print produced cherry blossoms with geisha. And especially the nighttime, eerie, white, seductive color of cherry blossoms representing geisha, which is very interesting because geisha is outside of the normal society. They are not reproductive, whereas young Michael, the apprentice, is also represented by cherry blossoms. And then, as I said, the first slide about is agrarian productivity. So you have one hand productivity as well as reproductivity. And then on the other hand, you have what I call the alternative imagination, that is the geisha who are not reproductive outside of the society. And so the cherry blossoms can stand for those two opposite meanings. And then I would go through how the military used different cherry blossoms in the military insignia, and then ultimately as the symbol of so-called kamikaze operation. And then I have this young soldier who is donning cherry branches with petals on. And his brother sent me this photo, and I asked him, and one thing that was very rewarding for me was that these diaries were first produced personally by their father or brothers. At the time, Japan could not publish anything. And then later on, the regular publisher picked it up. And then I wasn't sure to what their reactions are going to be, my using their diaries. But they were all very happy because they did not want their life to be buried just within Japan. And so to be known, the real thoughts internationally was something that they really appreciated. And so that's this photo of the boy pilot was also given by his brother. And about 4,000 pilots who perished, 3,000 of them are boy pilots. And Onishi Takijiro, who instituted the kamikaze operation, was the first one to start the Air Force in Japan, not as a separate unit, but a part of Navy. And he thought that the young boys can be trained to be skillful pilots. So he started this boy pilots. Unfortunately, they did not leave massive diaries like the university students did. So it's very hard to have their thoughts, except to ask their relatives. And also there are some propaganda photos where they pose with smiling faces, and but they would not even identify who they are, when they were taken, and all that. So it's very difficult to find the thoughts and feelings of the boy pilots.
And after World War II, how were these symbols reclaimed or redirected?
Immediately after the war, they started the cherry blossom viewings, and only one Asahi newspaper journalist said that there's something about cherry blossom, it just doesn't settle with me. But then they all forgot, and in Japan I have a different version of these books, and they sold very well because they did not link these beautiful cherry blossoms they are celebrating with the military use of the cherry blossoms. And so after the war, the Ueno Park and all of these places are full of people celebrating cherry blossoms. And then I have a photo of an Indonesian who was dancing under the cherry blossoms. And there was one corner at the Ueno Park that was the only place that was open to anybody. And you can register to sing in karaoke. All other places are for a particular company or particular school. And so it's very exclusive. But there was one place that was, and then there was an Iranian who painted his face and the arms and everything white. And then had a wig and a Japanese woman's kimono. And so I visited him 3 times in a row, and he was very pleased and was eager to be photographed, although he was deported because he didn't have a proper permit.
Well, those cherry blossoms are still the occasion for what might be called one of the world's biggest picnics.
Yes, that's
in
Japan. That's right.
Well, it's a really intriguing topic. I have to say, I don't think I'll ever look at cherry blossoms quite the same way. They're much more complex as a symbol than I would have thought. Thanks for sharing your work with us.
Well, thank you so very much. I enjoyed introducing these soldiers who perished for nothing because of the government.
And they live in a certain way in your writings. Our guest has been Emiko Anuki Tierney, and I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.